My name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. I enjoyed the entertainment very much. That middle-aged lady who was sitting in the back of the room reminded me when I was drinking, I used to fall in love with people like her regularly. One time we were running out of money at the house, and my wife decided she would go on the streets. She came back the first night. She had $23.25. I asked her who gave her the quarter. She said, everybody. It is good to be with you at your conference. I've met some old friends that I've known. I've known C.D. a while. Some other members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've known from other places. And I also met a number of the Al-Anon ladies. I was surprised that there would be so many Al-Anon ladies here. I thought they'd all be in downtown Albany, where they're having a very important meeting of Al-Anon being held this evening in the mother church of all Al-Anon, the Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge. Let me tell you about my drinking. I don't want you to miss any of this. It's a thrill a minute. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City, and my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you may not understand it here in Georgia, but they drank in that neighborhood. You would actually see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. Yes. Difficult to believe, but true. If you looked at where I'd lived, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a few drinks from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. We had a large Irish family, but the strain of childbearing took its toll, and my father died when he was 35. I don't really remember what I had for my first drink. I showed up at the local joint in the neighborhood, and I ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon. I suspect it was a beer. That was the neighborhood drink. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it smelled. I liked the way it tastes. I liked what it did for my head. I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. I liked the fist fights and the Irish music. I like the bullshit. That's what I really like. And I spent 20 years pursuing that. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking, and I got into all of the difficulties you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly, when they were finished with me, because some college made a mistake, I was allowed to leave the neighborhood, and I went north to college. And when I got up there, my drinking changed. I found every time I moved, my drinking changed. There were no bars in that state, just restaurants. And they sat around at tables, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang college songs, and they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words to some of those songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over and was relatively safe. So one day I got a haircut and I joined the Navy. And I ended up on a minesweeper in San Francisco Harbor. And I hate to be indelicate at such a nice gathering, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, and the new man slept on top. Don't get ahead of me, Charlie. This is very difficult, what I'm doing here. I came back from my first liberty with all the beer in me I could buy, and I went to sleep, and I had one of these attacks. And I met the fellow that slept below me that night. He figured he must have figured that he'd be wet sometime in his naval career. It just hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. The rest of my naval career is undistinguished. I came back home to the neighborhood undecorated, unhonored, unloved. And everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was absent without leave from the New York City Police Department. He had thrown a citizen off a five-story roof, and the citizen had bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. So Billy went west and went back in the Marine Corps, more peaceful line of work. The government was giving $20 a week for 52 weeks to veterans. It was called the 5220 Club. I qualified for the club. I picked up a number of checks. I gravitated to the local joint. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions when I had one of those thoughts that drift in from time to time to alcoholics. I remembered that I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went back up there, and I arrived in the middle of a blizzard, and I walked into this place, and there they were, sitting around a table, drinking beer out of a bottle, singing no songs, wearing no shoes. So I got another pair of shoes, and now a grateful government was sending me a check every month, so I was relatively solvent and moderately drunk all the time. One day I was staggering around the campus in my usual condition, and I noticed a list of names on a bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate, and my name was on the list. And that was very good news. I thought I had another year to go. I called up the widow to come north and witness this great event, and that was a rather tender occasion. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. About 10 years later, I served as a trustee of that college, and I'd go to meetings, and they were still talking about my mother. It's not so often in the state of Vermont where they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. When I came back from college, the question was what to do. And I had some uncles that ran the family, and they had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman, because that's what my father had been, and that's what my brother had been. And that's what all my uncles and cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. But I told them I wasn't going to be a New York City cop. I was alcoholic, and I was going to do what I wanted to do. And I told them I'd received a scholarship to law school, and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. And that was received with mixed emotions. But that's what happened. I went into law school, and I didn't know anything about lawyers or law school. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. And I don't want to be disloyal to the profession that's done so well for me, but I have to tell you that when I arrived at law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. These guys were deadly, and they all had on a blue suit, and they wore eyeglasses. So as soon as I got into uniform, and I got a pair of glasses I really didn't need, I looked around for someone to drink with, a companion. My mother always told me, play with nice boys your own age. But nobody drank in that crowd. They're all students. They're all studying. They're all grinding it out. So I became the biggest grind they ever had in that school. and I did not drink. I went on the wagon for law school. I did not drink at all in my first year, and very rarely in the next 2 years. The result was that when I came out of school, I had done well, and I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It wasn't a total loss, however. I did learn to say, "Oh, really," instead of "No shit." Just testing you, just testing. My superiors there determined that I should be trained as a trial lawyer, and so I was sent up to New York City courthouse to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse too long when I discovered that all the smart guys were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I learned to drink in a more civilized, a more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with water and ice, and you sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals that surround the very, very dry martini. And to this night, to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they almost destroyed me. It was about this time in my natural development that it was necessary, in order to continue to evolve, that I become married. And I had located this lady, or she had located me. I don't know how those things work. Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife, I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. Ms. O'Keefe is from a totally different background than mine. She was raised in Westchester County, with a large home and devoted parents and servants and a fence and a dog. In a word, her family had a buck. I drank a lot in those days, but I knew what was going on. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. There was only one fight. My Uncle Bernie hit a waiter. After that, we settled down and we set up housekeeping, and Ms. O'Keefe then began to deliver children in a rather boring and monotonous fashion, and with the regularity that's known only to the devout Roman Catholic. And after about the second of these events, I received a phone call from the dean of the law school I had attended, and he wanted me to come by. So I went to see the dean, and he appointed me to the faculty, and I became Professor O'Keefe. And I responded to that appointment with great alacrity. There I was, the boy professor. And I was very concerned about that job because I really wasn't sure what there was in my background that would justify that. And I knew that I drank too much, so I decided that I would drink less. Made a certain amount of sense. If you drink too much, you should drink less. So I entered into a phase where I thought I would control my drinking. I was then 26 years of age when I thought I'd have to control my drinking. And I was very unsuccessful at that. But the way things worked out, I turned out to be a pretty good teacher. And once I had that under control, once I understood that it was possible for me to conduct a class in a law school, then there was no necessity to control my drinking. So I went back out to drink the way I like to drink. And I only knew the one way to drink. My father died when I was 2 years of age, and my brother Billy was 4 years older than I was. And Billy was a big, tall, handsome New York Irishman. And Billy was my hero, and I did everything just like Billy. And I drank just like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the place went on fire, or the cops arrived, or something happened to interfere with the drinking. And I went back out to do that kind of drinking after I'd been teaching for about 3 years. And I roamed around the city of New York, and I did a lot of things that lawyers do when they roam around the city of New York. I did a lot of things that aren't important anymore. I served on all kinds of commissions and committees, and I served under a number of appointments by a number of governors and mayors, and the school I was teaching at was fairly prestigious in New York and very political. I even was among a group of men in the middle 50s who, from New York, who had surrounded the candidacy of a young senator from Massachusetts that you will remember. And in this period of time, too, Mrs. O'Keefe and I bought a large house up in Westchester County. And we added up the 6 or 7 children, the usual number, and also the usual number of motor vehicles and the usual memberships and the usual clubs. And I was teaching and also practicing law and politicking. And had you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. As a matter of fact, I would have told you I was doing very well whether you asked me or not. The truth of the matter was, at this time, at age 34, I had turned into a daily drunk. My day would have killed an ordinary man. I used to come to every morning in that wet bed because the problem with the kidneys had continued, unabated, all those years. And I would struggle out of that wet sack, and I'd begin my morning calisthenics. My calisthenics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I'd have all the water running, the water in the shower, and the water in the tub, and the water in the sink. Because I did not want Ms. O'Keefe and all those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would come downstairs in my sincere blue suit, carrying over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry. Because Ms. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children. And she did not think that a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. You can imagine a man of my stature in the community starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I used to keep a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that Daddy's Juice. I used to take a few bangs on Daddy's Juice, and then the question was, would I throw up in front of all of those people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, it was all over. Sooner or later, I'd take the train in the Grand Central, and as soon as I arrived there, help was at hand, because if you know anything about the city of New York, Grand Central Terminal is not simply a railroad station. It is a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I would tear around the tunnels and pop up like a mole here or there and do a repair job. And then I'd head for the school. And as soon as I got into that imposing institution, my first thought was, how do I get out of here? And I'd get out and I'd tear across town and steal. Every morning I would steal $20. From the petty cash, and then I'd be in business. And I'd end up in the bar where I first started out, down by the courthouse. And by this time, the other lawyers were treating me like a playmate or a mascot or something. I'd run in and I'd throw up my dough, and I'd buy a drink, and they'd buy a drink. And the bartender would buy a drink, and then we'd all buy a drink. And it was marvelous. And about every 15 minutes, somebody would be putting a drink in front of me, and we would eat or not eat, or do some business or not do some business. It really wasn't important. I had it figured out in some peculiar alcoholic fashion that I was particularly brilliant at about 2 o'clock. So I'd schedule classes for 2, and I'd zoom up there and shortchange those law students, and then I'd be out, and I'd tear over to Grand Central to commute on the train. Now, even though I grew up in the city of New York, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12, and then I'd take a train that was leaving. It didn't have to go to where I lived. If it was leaving, that was good enough for me. And I got to see a great deal more of Connecticut than any civilized person. Sooner or later, I'd arrive home, and I'd bounce off a few walls and take what was left of Daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old cheese glass that some kid had left laying around. And I'd inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one that drank in that house in those days. And I'd have 3 or 4 pops, and then I would eat or not eat, depending on my mood. Evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Lawyers are very fond of civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car or puking on some hostess's sofa or playing a little grab ass with the ladies of Larchmont and a sorrier looking crop you have never seen. Most nights home, I'd just stay home and vegetate, and I'd look at television with one eye, like just trying to get those sets to come together. And I'd watch the TV with one eye, and I would drink, and I'd go through the programming and through the news and through the late show and on into the morning, drinking and watching television with one eye. And then my big moment would come when they played the Star Spangled Banner. And the Marines would be going up Mount Suribachi. And those destroyers would be coming through the water. And they'd be playing that song. And I would cry. I would cry and weep and sob. And then I'd go upstairs and wet the bed, and that was it. I was a great leaker. I leaked from all ends. Well, as anybody who's ever been married can tell you, while all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. But I pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she is my wife. How much can she know? Secondly, she is not an attorney, and I would tell her that. And then we would have a discussion, and I would explain to her, because she is ignorant, that some people drink more than other people. It's a relative thing. And based upon the relativity of it all, I would explain to her that I didn't drink very much at all. As a matter of fact, I would say to her, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much as your mother. Then I'd have to leave. I'd be gone for 3 or 4 days. She had offended my mother. That's un-American. Well, this drove her wacky, and she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. And this explained a great many things to him, and he sent her home to my house with a message. And the message she brought me was very bad news indeed. It was a nice room in that house. We don't live in that house anymore. We had some more children. We childrened ourselves out of that house. That's a very polite expression of how we came to move from that house. And anyhow, in that house, there was a very nice den. It was very pleasant. It was paneled and had a fireplace. It was a very comfortable room. And on the wall of that room, I had erected a shrine. Now, this shrine is not any saint that you ever heard about. This shrine was to me. And there were plaques and proclamations and diplomas and awards and all of the stuff that lawyers collect all over the walls. And there were mementos of political campaigns, and there were letters, you know, Dear Ray, best regards, Jack, that kind of stuff. It was all over there. And I would watch the television one eye and drink. And during a commercial, I'd look up at the wall and I'd say to myself, you are doing some job here, boy, and I keep on drinking. Because that shrine was conclusive evidence that everything was all right. And one night, this Mrs. O'Keefe, this woman, came to pay a visit to the shrine. And the message she brought me was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the professor, as an alcoholic. Oh, that was very bad news. I rose to defend myself, as was my custom, and I started my jury address, which was also my custom. And the first point I made, I thought, was a good one. I think it's still a good one, Ray. I took a very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without having seen the patient. An all too common instance of shabby medical practice. I then launched into high gear and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. And at this point, the conversation was coming downhill at a very fast rate, and then it happened. I don't know how this happened. I cannot explain to you how this happened. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk I'm giving here. But in the middle of all of this yelling, I suddenly stopped, and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe for the first time that I'd ever admitted it to anyone that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. Because 3 days later, I was a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I had only been there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. They had sandbagged the old professor. And I was overcome with great feelings of outrage and self-pity because, in addition to everything else, it happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing by. And I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day I had attained age 35 and therefore under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. Washington and Jefferson, I think, were there for the weekend. And he gave me some pills and he went away. And then for the next week or so, I shook, I sweat, I did everything else terrific that you can think about. And I finally came up for air. And I was then visited by the staff of the hospital. And they, of course, were psychiatrists. And the first one in to see me was the head of the hospital, and I would have expected no one less. And he fixed his cool, professional glance upon me, and he asked me that question that so many people insist on asking alcoholics. It's such a brilliant line of inquiry. He said, "Tell me, Professor, why do you drink so much?" So I told him of my wealthy parents. I told him that Mamsie and Dada used to travel a great deal, and I had been left in the hands of cruel servants who were black, and I had become insecure and turned toward alcohol. He was very sympathetic. About an hour later, one of his colleagues came in and asked me the same question. So I told him, after all, one doesn't lie to a professional. I told him of my impoverished youth. I told him of the beatings I'd received at the hands of my drunken mother. I even told him about the time my sister Marie stole my rubber duck when I was 3 years of age. He told me I had come to the right place. Said help was at hand. Said with his help and with the help of medical science, one day I would drink safely again. And I said, "Thank you, doctor." He was my kind of a doctor, that doctor. And he went away, and about an hour later, another one came by. He is the last psychiatrist I have ever seen, with the exception of one I used to drive to meetings from time to time. This was a man of dubious medical qualifications and a pronounced Middle European accent, and he was fascinated by two things. One was my professorial status, and the other was the fact that I was wearing sneakers in January. He found some mysterious relevance to the footwear. It had escaped me completely until he brought it up, and we had a long chat about it. And then he popped the question. I gave him a sexual aberration that drove him right out of the room. I suppose he had figured he'd been given a great degenerate to work with, and perhaps he had. Well, I wasn't as smart as I'd like everybody to think, because they had a staff meeting, and they came to the conclusion that there was a fraud in their hospital. And so they sent for Mrs. O'Keefe. And I was brought into a large room, and she was in the middle of it, hysterical. She told me that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. I said, "Let's go." But she prevailed upon me to stay, and I went back up there, and I was in this place. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. It was just a place. It was a nut house, of sort of a very fancy rattle box. And I was engaged in a form of therapy that never did catch on for the disease of alcoholism. It's called a game of Monopoly. I was playing Monopoly with three guys who were there. They weren't alcoholics. They were just there. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do very, very well. I had the boardwalk, I had a number of hotels, and I was very happy with the Monopoly therapy. But I was into about the third day of the Monopoly marathon, and they said I had another visitor. I didn't know what that would be, so I went into my large executive type padded cell to wait. And through the door of that room came this very imposing-looking man, and he told me he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the hospital had given up on me, and they had asked him to speak to me of our program. And I immediately reverted to my origins, and I almost had her by the throat. I said, "Alcohol, what are you, out of your mind?" And I started with him. And he told me to shut up. Really. I immediately forgave him because I knew that they had forgotten to tell him who I was. So I continued to speak. He told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing looking man, and I was not a well person. And so for the first time in 35 years, I sat and he began to explain to me, as I have been trying to indicate to you, and as we are instructed in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, what his life had been like, how he had come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what his life had been since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, "Do you mean outside to meetings, sir?" He said, "Outside." I said, "I'll go." Besides that, he gave me matches. And nobody else allowed me to have any matches. And that showed, I thought, a certain degree of confidence in me. And that's how it began with me. He drove me all over. It was in January of 1963. And he made arrangements for me to go locally, and I came out and I began to attend meetings where I lived. And I don't remember so much of all of that. I was too new, too nervous, too afraid, and too everything. And besides, the hospital had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills that they used to insist on giving alcoholics. I was dealing with that lethal segment of the medical profession that considers the disease of alcoholism to be caused by some type of a Valium deficiency. And I was walking around eating these things and my head buzzed a lot. But I know myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined something. I would serve a term as your president. You would give me a plaque. I would put it on the wall of the shrine. And that's it, onward and upward. Well, it should come as no surprise to you, although it was a terrible shock to me, to find out some 10 months later, I was very, very drunk. I lasted from January until October of 1963. And then I was very, very drunk. And this time I was drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the great power that is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time. I won't bring you through it because it just takes too long and still makes the hair on the back of my neck go up. But just let me indicate to you that it was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I never knew when I'd be drinking. I never knew when it would begin. I certainly never knew where I would be when I was finished. I would drink a week and then I wouldn't drink a month. I'd drink a month and then I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and come to these meetings. I would come to these meetings and then I would drink. Things began to happen to me in this period of time that had never happened to me before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time that I no longer consider to be significant. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured professor of law, and that all of the appointments and all of the honors and all of the prestige and all of the dollars that went through with that position were taken from me in a matter of about 15 minutes. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those who were around me. All of this happened to me in this period of time, but this is not what I'm speaking to you about. What I now understand was happening in my case, and perhaps in yours, is that there was a terrible, terrible wasting of my spirit. That spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat and separates me even from each of you. That spirit which gives to this particular form whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing that I could do about it. I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous. It did not work for me. By this time, I'd been everywhere else. I'd been through the drying out places and the farms and the sanitariums and the hospitals and the doctors and the nurses. And I'd been through the politicians and the jobs and the money. And I'd been up and down every avenue there was. And the result was always the same. I was drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I had a memory. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew about my family. I had been to the funerals. I knew what happened to people who drank the way I did. But the book tells us that self-knowledge avails us nothing. I knew it, but it didn't mean anything to me. And if I gave this matter any thought at all, I would think to myself, well, if this is the way it is, then this is the way it is. And I continued to drink. And truly, truly, as I sit here and stand here before you, truly, I did not think that I would ever stop. And then one day, my time came. My time came one day. I don't know any more about this than you do, but it seems to me that there is a time for all of us, and it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we are simply not permitted to sink. And it seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. Now, I don't know where this line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is an individual and a personal thing. And it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. The man called one day from a veterans hospital in Minneapolis, and he told me that my brother had died in the veterans hospital, where they had taken him from the skid row of Minneapolis. And so my brother and my hero died the way alcoholics do, without friends, without family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. And for other people, it can be something fairly trivial. But the line is there somewhere, and we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. But come to it we must. And I arrived at a day that really wasn't so different from many other days. I was 2 or 3 days away from a drink. I was in this place where I worked. I was nervous. I was thirsty. And I thought I'd go downstairs and have a few. That's what I always had done. But instead of that, I was given the great grace, the great opportunity to call a longtime friend of mine who was a longtime member of this program. And his name is John, and he is my sponsor. And John worked nearby, and he came right over. And he walked into that room, and he looked so good, and I felt so bad. And I asked him what I would have to do to be as successful as he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John gave me that look that he has, and he said, "Don't drink. Go to meetings. You'll be all right." Well, I didn't want him to tell me that. And I told him I didn't want him to tell me that. That's much too simple for someone like me. I explained to him, I said, "The trouble with you is you don't understand the problem." He said, "The real problem is where I work, this place where I work. So a lawyer of my talent should not be in a place like this." Yeah, he said, "Well, don't drink. You go to meetings. It'll get a little better." I said, "Now at home it's worse, you know. She's got the court order and I don't even go up there anymore." Yeah, he said, "Well, don't drink and you go to meetings. That'll work out." He said, "I'm being sued by Bankers Trust for the money, John." Yeah, he said, "I heard about that." "Well, don't drink and you go to meetings." Not much to that. I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did John, because he made a couple of phone calls and he said, "Come on, Raymond, you're not doing much." And he took me over to Grand Central and he stuck me on a train to Larchmont. It's about 40 minutes. Halfway up, I reconsidered. You understand. I must have panicked when I called him. "Don't drink, right? Don't drink my ass. Wait till this train stops." And then I got off the platform, and standing on the platform of the Larchmont station was my mailman, a guy named Al. And Al said, "Get in the car." And I said, "Get out of here, Al. I don't hang around with mailmen." Al said, "Some guy from New York called me about you. Get in a car." Well, a man of my stature cannot afford to have a fist fight with a mailman, or anybody else for that matter. So I got in Al's car. I said, "Al, I have a lot of problems, Al." Yeah, he said, "Well, don't drink. You got an email." So if any of you are foolish enough to seek my advice because I'm from out of town, don't drink. You go to meetings. You'll be all right. And Al came by and that night and he took me up to the meeting. And I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. And that was November 24th, 1965. First I had that day. And I had that day because two members of this fellowship were so filled with the gratitude of this fellowship that they took what God sent that day, a drunken, dishonest, arrogant man. And because they were so very grateful for what they had received, they gave me a day. And because of that day, all of the other days have followed. I was going to meetings every day, every night. Now I still go to meetings every night. John told me that you stay sober the way you got sober. I got sober because I went every night. I still go every night. I would see John every day. I'd see Al every night. I get my instructions. And I've been hanging around for a few months, whatever it was. And one day John said to me, he said, "You know, Raymond, you're not such a bad fellow, and you hang around pretty good." He said, "Trouble with you is you're ignorant." Nice, huh? He said, "You don't know anything about the program." He said, "You just hang around. And you don't drink. You don't know anything about the program. You're ignorant." He gave me the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Read this book." And because I am the way I am, I said, "Ignorant, right? Rarely have we seen anyone fail who has thoroughly followed." And he put up his hand. He said, "Read it again." And I said, "Yes, John." Every conversation I ever had with that man was only over when I said, "Yes, John." And I began to read again the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He was right. I was ignorant. I had no idea that that book had been written some 5 years after Bill and Bob met in 1935 in Akron, Ohio. I had no idea that 100 or so men and women had become sober before that book was written. I did not understand that the steps that are contained in the fifth chapter of that book are steps literally taken by these men and women as they became sober. I thought when first I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that if I told you my name was Ray O'Keefe and I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step of this program. Oh, I'm an alcoholic and that's my name, but the men and the women who founded this program did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives were unmanageable, and their lives were unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. It was all the same thing with them. They were powerless. They had no power. They were without power. It says in the book that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. He is powerless. But they didn't drink. And time began to pass for them. And time has passed for the conference at Albany, Georgia. And if you come here new, time will pass for you. And time has a wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that this power could restore them to sanity. And this was not just a casual opinion that they had, or an offhand reference that they shared. They believed this. This was vital to them. They believed that there was a power greater than their own. And as they believe, I believe. And so firm and so true and so real was this belief that they were able to make a decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power that they had come to believe in, this God as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright, because at a time in the history of our country, no one else had this notion. They conceived alcoholism to be a disease. They conceived it to be a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual, a disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirits. And when they stopped drinking, they found that their bodies responded fairly quickly. And when they came to believe that they could be restored to sanity, they began to notice a mental recovery. It was slower than the physical recovery, but it was perceptible. They could see it. And when they made that decision, that was the key that opened the door. And that decision laid down the basis for a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they were smart enough to know that it isn't enough to stop drinking and start praying. A lot of people have tried that. It doesn't work. They knew that if they were to become sober, somehow they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They could be searching because by now they were relatively clear. They could be fearless because they had made a decision to place their life into the hands and care of a power greater than their own, of this God of their understanding. Imagine an alcoholic without fear. That is impossible. It embarrasses me to tell you that the ruling emotion of my life when I drank was fear. For all of those years, the great man and the boy professor was afraid most of the time. But this program helps with that. And when they were finished with this inventory, so great was the affection of these people one for the other, that they were able to admit the inventory to themselves, to this God of their understanding, and then they were able to bring it to someone else. It was a great relief for me finally to bring that to my sponsor. It was he who made clear to me the exact nature of my wrongs. I was always the kind of a guy that wanted everybody to know who I was, but I never let anybody know what I was. It was a great relief to get this off. And then these men and women developed an attitude which was difficult for me. They became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And with compelling logic, they went to this great power that they had come to believe in, and they humbly asked that power to take these defects from him. They prayed to him. They called him their creator. And they said they wanted him to take it all, the good and the bad, so that they could be useful and do his bidding. It's very much like the third step prayer. And it began to work for them. And I think it's worked for millions and millions of people since. And no matter what else is ever written or thought or said about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the one thing upon which there must be unanimous opinion is that it works. It certainly works. And if anyone had any doubt of that, all they would have to do was come here to any of the meetings that have been held here this weekend and just sit down and look around. That's all the proof that it needs, that it works. And these people, these men and women who founded our program, understood that there had been great wreckage in their lives. They had done great damage in their lives, as I had done in mine. So they wrote a list of everyone they had ever harmed. And they became willing to make amends to everyone on their list. And they just didn't talk about it. They went out and they did it. You may recall the book tells us of Dr. Bob's first day when he began to stop drinking. He got home late and Bill asked him where he'd been. And he said he was out mending fences. It's an old Vermont expression. He was making amends the very first day that he came into the fellowship. And I don't think we ought to wait too long to do whatever it is that we're required to do, mainly because of the benefits that flow from the ninth step and the eight steps that precede it. And those benefits I have heard twice now from this podium since the time I've been here. And they are something that I think is something very special. It says in our book, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door upon it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us all of the things we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I am able to report to you that each and every one of those promises has come into my life, wholly and solely and simply because I am a member of this fellowship. And by this time, these men and women were sober, and they had been restored to sanity. And they knew that what had been given to them was something very precious, and so they maintained it. They resolved that they would practice more steps in order to maintain this great gift that they had received. They knew they could not afford the luxury of a resentment. They knew they could not be resentful or hateful. They knew that if they were resentful, they would drink. And if they drank, they would die. And so when they were wrong, they promptly admitted that they were wrong. And so real and so true was their reliance upon this power greater than their own, this God of their understanding, that they sought to improve their conscious contact with God. They did that by prayer, and they did that by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very fine, a very excellent form of meditation. It is the form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened. On the odd chance that this power that they had come to believe in would speak to them. And this power that they had come to believe in did speak to them in their groups, at their meetings. And they prayed, brothers. They prayed. And when they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry it out. I don't know how it was with you, but it always seemed to me when I was very, very young and going through the schools, I always had this feeling that I did not belong. I thought I was in the wrong family. I really thought that. I thought I was in the wrong neighborhood. I knew I was in the wrong schools, and I didn't belong with those people. And this feeling persisted in me for a long, long time, and it persisted even though I was going through the system successfully. I was a successful kid. I had friends. I was very good at school. I had very good work to do. I lived in the right place and the right, all of that stuff. But I always had that feeling that I didn't belong, and that feeling is down in here somewhere where the wind blows and it makes the days very long and it makes the nights very dark. And then I came here to you, and I learned to pray in a different way. And in the 12 and 12 on the subject of prayer and the 11th step, it says at the end of that chapter, and this is not a quote, but it's close, it says there that one of the greatest benefits that prayer brings to us is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We are no longer lost or frightened or alone or purposeless. That despite all of the evidence in the world around us, we understand that the real values of life are truth and justice and love. And that we understand that a loving God watches over us. And that we know that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And I am able to report to you that for many, many years, that sense of belonging has come to me. And when I tell you that my name is Ray O'Keefe and that I am an alcoholic, and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am really telling you who I am, what I am, and where I belong. And that's very important to me, to finally to have come to rest in a place where I belong. It isn't so much that I am invited here to speak with you. I belong here. It isn't so much that I drop in from out of town. I'm supposed to be here. I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that really does it for me. A little later, these men and women found a prayer that they appropriated, and you and I have already prayed that prayer. And this time they prayed for themselves. But the only thing they asked for was peace of mind. So they asked God to grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. They did change. Something happened to these men and women. Something has happened to me. I think something happens to everyone who comes here and puts this program into their lives and puts their lives into this program. There was a great difference in these men and women. There was a great difference between being drunk and being sober. There was a great conversion of their attitudes. There was a great substitution of their standards. And this difference in them, the difference between being drunk and being sober, they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were hopeless and helpless and powerless. These were the ones who had no power. But having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts and in our program one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually had the power to save life. And the only thing they were using was the great power of example of one drunk for another. And armed with that power, and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffered. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a night in June in 1985, the 50th year of the miracle, in a place called Albany, in the great state of Georgia. And that, my dear, dear brothers, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew what my sponsor knows. They know what my friend Jim knows, that there is so much more to this program besides a simple device to keep us from drinking. They knew that what had been given to them was an entirely new way of living. And in order to enjoy that new way of life, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. And so where they had been, as I always was, very dishonest, they tried not to be so dishonest. Where they had been, as I always was, very arrogant, they tried not to be so arrogant. Happily for me and for us all, they said we are not saints. They said this is not a program of spiritual perfection. They said it is a program of spiritual progress, and my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe that I can progress in the program if I don't drink and go to the meeting. I could keep you for the next month or two to tell you of all the good things that have happened to me since I have become sober, but I would not keep you that long. If you have a good wish for me, and I know that you do, please be assured that anything that you might wish for me has already happened in my life, wholly, solely, and simply because I am a member of this fellowship. Everything, every single thing that the disease of alcoholism took from me, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has returned to me. Every honor, every position, every dollar have all come back in ways that are so mysterious that I no longer even think how to understand them. They just happen. I will just tell you two things to give you an indication of what's been going on. When I was fired as a law teacher in 1963, I knew, like I knew my own name, that I would never, ever be able to teach in a university school of law again. There are only 8,000 of those jobs in the United States. And everybody knows everybody, and everybody knew why I was fired. And so when I had been sober about 13 years, I was appointed a professor of law at a brand new law school that had opened up in New York State, close to where I was living and working. And a little while later, I went to a dinner of the law school that had fired me. I had been asked to be a master of ceremonies at this event, and I was asked to introduce the dais, and there was the usual dais for that school, the governor, the senators, everybody, Waldorf Astoria, three tiers. And I worked my way through all of that. And I had been eating with the dean, sitting next to the dean. We were just chatting during the lunch, and I kept introducing people. And the last fellow I introduced was the dean of the law school, who was a newer dean. And he gave a very nice deanly report about things at that university school of law. And at the end of it, he announced that the next thing he was going to do was to restore Professor O'Keefe to the faculty. So about 2,500 lawyers stood up and cheered. And I had no idea what was going on. And all of a sudden, I was right back at the same school that had fired me. So I stayed there about a year, and then I quit. They can't push me around. Because they had opened up a brand new law school in Florida. And I had a long time been a member of the Florida Bar, and I was thinking of how to retire to Florida. My kids are pretty well all grown up. And all of a sudden they opened up a new law school, and all of a sudden I'm back full-time teaching law. And I live in Florida. Don't ask me how that works, because I assure you, you can't go from being fired when you're tenured back to where I am now, a full-tenured senior professor. It's not just not done, that's all. It just never happens. The next thing that I will tell you that's going on with the O'Keefes is something that's much more important. I bring you the warm and the fraternal greetings of five of my children who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if this is a record, but I'm getting a lot of distance on it. I think that's about what I have to say. I would be remiss if I did not thank the committee or whoever it was who had the very good judgment to bring me here. I've enjoyed being here. I've heard speakers that I needed to hear. I always listen with great attention to Monsignor Williams when he preaches at me, speaks to me. And I met Poor Boy before, and all the other speakers that are here. I am one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who gets around. And everywhere I go, I say the same thing. So if you've heard this before, you're hearing it again. I make no apology for that. And when I end, I always say the same thing. I refer you to a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is dear to me. It's called The Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that pamphlet, at the end of it, the author takes a biblical turn. And he recalls a time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And so these two men found the Lord and they walked with him a while. And one day they stopped him and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for thousands of years? Or should we wait for another?" He really did not answer that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell him only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and the lame walk. Tell John that the deaf hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everybody knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear brothers, here in Albany, in Happy Conference Assembly, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the blind do see and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again through the longest day and into the darkest night the good news of this program brought to the alcoholic who still suffers, the poor in spirit. Thank you.